so I also worried about losing too much weight too rapidly. That is why, having tried ADF for a short while, I decided to cut back to fasting 2 days a week. I now have my own experiences of this to fall back on, together with the experiences of thousands of others who have written to me. But what trials have been done on two-day fasts in humans? Well, Dr. Michelle Harvey, a dietitian based at the Genesis Breast Cancer Prevention Centre at the Wythenshaw Hospital in Manchester, has done a number of studies assessing the effects of a two-day fast on female volunteers. In a recent study, she divided 115 women into three groups. One group was asked to stick to a 1,500-calorie-a-day Mediterranean diet and was also encouraged to avoid high-fat foods and alcohol. Another group was asked to eat normally 5 days a week, but to eat a 650-calorie low-carbohydrate diet on the other 2 days. A final group was simply asked to avoid carbohydrates for 2 days a week, but was otherwise not calorie-restricted. After 3 months, the women on the two-day diets had lost an average of 4 kilograms, nearly 9 pounds. This was almost twice as much as the full-time dieters, who had lost an average of just 2.4 kilograms, about 5 pounds. Insulin resistance had also improved significantly in the two-day diet groups. I'll be coming back to insulin later. Now, the focus of Michelle's work is trying to reduce breast cancer risk through dietary interventions. Being obese and having high levels of insulin resistance are both risk factors. On the Genesis website, www.genesisuk.org, she points out that they have been studying intermittent fasting at the Genesis Breast Cancer Prevention Unit for over 6 years, and that their research has shown that cutting down on your calories for 2 days a week gives the same benefits, possibly more, than by going on a normal calorie-reduced diet. She writes, "To date, our research has concluded that intermittent diets appear to be a safe, viable, alternative approach to weight loss and maintaining a lower weight in comparison to daily dieting." Is it just calories? If you eat 500 or 600 calories 2 days a week and don't significantly overcompensate during the rest of the week, then you will lose weight in a steady fashion. But is there any evidence that intermittent fasting does more than that? I recently came across one particularly fascinating study suggesting that when you eat can almost be as important as what you eat. In this study, scientists from the Salk Institute for Biological Studies took two groups of mice and fed them on a high-fat diet. The mice got exactly the same amount of food to eat, the only difference being that one group of mice was allowed to eat whenever they wanted, nibbling away when they were in the mood, rather like we do, while the other group of mice had to eat their food in an 8-hour time period. This meant that there were 16 hours of the day in which they were involuntarily fasting. After 100 days, there were some truly dramatic differences between the two groups of mice. The mice who had nibbled away at their fatty food had developed high cholesterol, high blood glucose, and had liver damage. The mice that had been forced to fast for 16 hours a day put on far less weight, 28% less, and suffered much less liver damage, despite having eaten exactly the same amount and quality of food. They also had lower levels of chronic inflammation, which suggests they had reduced risk of a number of diseases, including heart disease, cancer, stroke, and Alzheimer's. The Salk researchers' explanation for this is that all the time you are eating, your insulin levels are elevated, and your body is stuck in fat-storing mode. Only after a few hours of fasting is your body able to turn off the fat-storing and turn on the fat-burning mechanisms. So, if you are continually nibbling, your body will just continue making and storing fat, resulting in obesity and liver damage. So you can see that there is quite a lot of evidence that fasting offers multiple health benefits, as well as helping to achieve weight loss. I had been aware of some of these claims before I got really interested in fasting, and though initially sceptical, I was converted by the sheer weight of evidence. But there was one area of study that was a complete surprise. Research showing how fasting can improve mood and protect the brain from dementia and cognitive decline. This, for me, was something completely new, unexpected, and hugely exciting. Fasting and the brain. The brain, as Woody Allen once said, is my second favourite organ. I might even put it first, as without it nothing else would function. The human brain is around 3 pounds of pinkish, greyish gunk, with the consistency of tapioca. It has also been described as the most complex object in the known universe. It allows us to build, write poetry, dominate the planet, and even understand ourselves, something no other creature has ever succeeded in doing. It is also an extremely efficient energy-saving machine, doing all that complicated thinking and making sure our bodies are functioning properly while using the same energy as a 25-watt light bulb. The fact that our brains are normally so flexible and adaptable makes it even more tragic when they go wrong. I am aware that as I get older, my memory has become more fallible. I've compensated by using a range of memory tricks I've picked up over the years, but even so, I find myself occasionally struggling to remember names and dates. Far worse than this, however, is the fear that one day I may lose my mind entirely, perhaps developing some form of dementia. Obviously, I want to preserve my brain in as good a shape as possible, and for as long as possible. Fortunately, intermittent fasting seems to offer significant protection. The man I went to discuss my brain with was Professor Mark Mattson. Mark Mattson, a professor of neuroscience at the National Institute on Aging, is one of the most revered scientists in his field, the study of the aging brain. I find his work genuinely inspiring, suggesting as it does that fasting can help combat diseases like Alzheimer's, dementia, and memory loss. Although I could have taken a taxi to his office, I chose to walk. I am a big fan of walking. It not only burns calories, it also improves the mood, and it may also help retain your memory. Normally, as we get older, our brain shrinks, but one study found that in regular walkers, the hippocampus, an area of the brain essential for memory, actually expanded. Regular walkers have brains that in MRI scans look on average 2 years younger than the brains of those who are sedentary. Mark, who studies Alzheimer's, lost his own father to dementia. He told me that although it didn't directly motivate him to go into this particular line of research, when he started work on Alzheimer's disease, his father had not yet been diagnosed. It did give him insight. Alzheimer's affects around 26 million people worldwide, and the problem will grow as the population ages. New approaches are desperately needed, because the tragedy of Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia is that once you're diagnosed, it may be possible to delay, but not prevent, the inevitable deterioration. You are likely to get progressively worse, to the point where you need constant care for many years. By the end, you may not even recognize the faces of those you once loved. Can fasting make you clever? Just as Volta Longo had, Mark took me off to see some mice. Like Volta's mice, Mark's mice are genetically engineered. But they have been modified to make them more vulnerable to Alzheimer's. The mice I saw were in a maze, which they had to navigate in order to find food. Some of the mice perform this task with relative ease. Others get disorientated and confused. This task, and others like it, are designed to reveal signs that the mice are developing memory problems. A mouse that is struggling will quickly forget which arm of the maze it has already travelled down. The genetically engineered Alzheimer's mice will, if put on a normal diet, quickly develop dementia. By the time they are a year old, the equivalent of middle age in humans, they normally have obvious learning and memory problems. The animals put on an intermittent fast, something Mark prefers to call intermittent energy restriction, often go up to 20 months without any detectable signs of dementia. They only really start deteriorating towards the end of their lives. In humans, that would be the equivalent of developing signs of Alzheimer's at the age of 80 rather than at 50. I know which I would prefer. Disturbingly, when these mice are put on a typical junk food diet, they go downhill much earlier than even normally fed mice. We put mice on a high-fat and high-fructose diet, Mark said, and that has a dramatic effect. The animals have an earlier onset of the learning and memory problems, more accumulation of amyloid, and more problems with finding their way in a maze test. In other words, junk food makes these mice fat and stupid. One of the key changes that occurs in the brains of Mark's mice is increased production of a protein called brain-derived neurotrophic factor. BDNF has been shown to stimulate stem cells to turn into new nerve cells in the hippocampus. As I mentioned earlier, this is a part of the brain that is essential for normal learning and memory. But why should the hippocampus grow in response to fasting? Mark points out that from an evolutionary perspective, it makes sense. After all, the times when you need to be smart and on the ball are when there's not a lot of food lying around. As he explained, if an animal is in an area where there's limited food resources, it's important they're able to remember where food is, remember where hazards are, predators, and so on. We think that people in the past were able to respond to hunger with increased cognitive ability had a survival advantage. We don't know for sure if humans do grow new brain cells in response to fasting. To be absolutely certain, researchers would need to put volunteers on an intermittent fast and then kill them, take their brains out, and look for signs of new neural growth. It seems unlikely that many people would volunteer for such a project. But what they are doing is a study where volunteers fast and then MRI scans are used to see if the size of their hippocampi changes over time. As I mentioned earlier, these techniques have been used in humans to show that regular exercise, such as walking, increases the size of the hippocampus. Hopefully, similar studies will show that 2 days a week of intermittent fasting is good for learning and memory. On a purely anecdotal level, and using a sample size of one, it seems to work. Before starting the fast diet, I did a sophisticated memory test online. 2 months in, I repeated the test, and my performance had indeed improved. If you are interested in doing something similar, then I suggest you go to www.cognitivefun.net. That is www.cognitivefun.net. Fasting and mood. One of the things that Professor Walter Longo and others told me before I began my 4-day fast was that it would be tough initially, but that after a while I would start to feel more cheerful, which was indeed what happened. Similarly, I was surprised to discover how positive I have felt while doing intermittent fasting. I expected to feel tired and crabby on my fasting days, but not at all. So is this simply a psychological effect, that people who do intermittent fasting and lose weight feel good about themselves? Or are there also chemical changes that are influencing mood? According to Professor Mark Mattson, one of the reasons people may find intermittent fasting relatively easy to do is thanks to the effects of BDNF. Brain-derived neurotrophic factor not only seems to protect the brain against the ravages of dementia and age-related mental decline, but it may also improve your mood. There have been a number of studies going back many years that suggest rising levels of BDNF have an antidepressant effect. At least they do in rodents. In one study, they injected BDNF directly into the brains of rats and found this had similar effects to repeated use of a standard antidepressant. Another paper found that electric shock therapy, which is known to be effective in severe depression, seems to work, at least in part, because it stimulates the production of higher levels of BDNF. Mark Mattson believes that within a few weeks of starting a 2-day-a-week fasting regime, BDNF levels will start to rise. suppressing anxiety and elevating mood. He doesn't currently have the human data to fully support his claim, but he is doing trials on volunteers, which involve, amongst other things, collecting regular samples of cerebrospinal fluid, the liquid that bathes your brain. He's doing this to measure the changes that occur during intermittent fast. Now, this is not a trial for the faint-hearted, as it requires regular spinal taps. But as Mark pointed out to me, many of his volunteers are already undergoing early signs of cognitive change, so they are extremely motivated. Mark is keen to study and promote the benefits of intermittent fasting, as he is genuinely worried about the likely effects of the current obesity epidemic on our brains and on our society. He also thinks that if you are considering intermittent fasting, you should get going sooner rather than later. As he put it, the age-related cognitive declines in Alzheimer's disease, the events that are occurring in the brain at the level of the nerve cells and the molecules in the nerve cells, those changes are occurring very early, probably decades before the subject starts to have learning and memory problems. That's why it is critical to start dietary regimes early on, when people are young or middle-aged, so they can slow down the development of these processes in the brain and live to be 90 with their brain functioning perfectly well. Now, like Mark, I'm convinced the brain benefits from short periods abstaining from food. This is an exciting and fast-developing area of research that many will watch with great interest. Beyond the brain, though, intermittent fasting also has measurable, beneficial effects on other parts of the body, on your heart, on your blood profile, and on your risk of cancer. And that's where we'll turn now. Fasting and the heart. One of the main reasons I decided to try fasting was that tests had suggested I was heading for serious problems with my cardiovascular system. Nothing has happened yet, but the warning signs were flashing amber. Medical tests showed that my blood levels of LDL, low-density lipoprotein, the bad cholesterol, were disturbingly high, as were the levels of my fasting glucose. To measure fasting glucose, you have to fast overnight, then give a sample of blood. My results suggested that I was already in the diabetic range. There are many reasons why you should do all you can to avoid becoming a diabetic, not least the fact that it dramatically increases your risk of having a heart attack or stroke. Fasting glucose is an important thing to measure, because if it is high, that is an indication that all is not well with your insulin levels. Insulin, the fat-making hormone. When we eat food, particularly food rich in carbohydrates, our blood glucose levels rise and the pancreas, an organ below the ribs and near the left kidney, starts to churn out insulin. Glucose is the main fuel that our cells use for energy, but the body does not like having high levels of it circulating in the blood. The job of insulin, a hormone, is to regulate blood glucose levels, ensuring they are neither too high nor too low. It normally does this with great precision. The problem comes when the pancreas gets overloaded. Insulin is a sugar controller. It aids the extraction of glucose from blood and then stores it in places like your liver or your muscles in a stable form called glycogen, to be used when and if it is needed. What is less commonly known is that insulin is also a fat controller. It inhibits something called lipolysis, the release of stored body fat. At the same time, it forces fat cells to take up and store fat from your blood. Insulin makes you fat. High levels lead to increased fat storage, low levels to fat depletion. The trouble with constantly consuming lots of sugary, carbohydrate-rich foods and drinks, as we increasingly do, is this requires a release of more and more insulin to deal with the glucose surge. Up to a point, your pancreas will cope by pumping out ever larger quantities of insulin. This leads to greater fat deposition and also increases the risk of cancer. Naturally enough, this cannot go on forever. If you continue to produce ever larger quantities of insulin, your cells will eventually rebel and become resistant to its effects. It's rather like shouting at your children. You can keep escalating things, but after a certain point, they will simply stop listening. Eventually, the cells stop responding to insulin. Your blood glucose levels now stay permanently high, and you will find you have joined the 285 million people around the world who have type 2 diabetes. It is a massive and rapidly growing problem worldwide. Over the last 20 years, numbers have risen almost tenfold, and there is no obvious sign that this trend is slowing. Diabetes is associated with an increased risk of heart attack, stroke, impotence, going blind, and losing your extremities due to poor circulation. It is also associated with brain shrinkage and dementia. This is not a pretty picture. One way to prevent the downward spiral into diabetes is to cut back on the carbohydrates and instead start eating more vegetables and fat, since these foods do not lead to such big spikes in blood glucose. Nor do they have such a dramatic effect on insulin levels. The other way is to try intermittent fasting. How intermittent fasting affects insulin sensitivity. In a study from 2005, 8 healthy men were asked to fast every other day, 20 hours a day, for 2 weeks. On the day before their fasting days, they were asked to stop eating at 10 in the evening, then not eat again until 6 p.m. the following evening. They were also asked to eat heartily the rest of the time to make sure they did not lose any weight. The idea behind this experiment was to test the so-called thrifty hypothesis. The idea is that since we evolved at a time of feast and famine, the best way to eat is to mimic those times. At the end of the 2 weeks, there were no changes in the volunteers' weight or body fat composition, which is what the researchers had intended. There was, however, a big change in their insulin sensitivity. In other words, after just 2 weeks of intermittent fasting, the same amount of circulating insulin now had a much bigger effect on the volunteers' ability to store glucose or break down fat. The researchers wrote jubilantly that by subjecting healthy men to cycles of feast and famine, we changed their metabolic status for the better. They also added that, to our knowledge, this is the first study in humans in which an increased insulin action on whole body glucose uptake and adipose tissue lipolysis has been obtained by means of intermittent fasting. I don't know what impact intermittent fasting has had on my insulin sensitivity. It's a test that is hard to do and extremely expensive. But what I do know is that the effects on my blood sugar have been spectacular. Before I started fasting, my blood glucose levels were those of a diabetic. The last time I had my levels measured, they were down into the normal range. This is an incredibly impressive response. My doctor, who was preparing to put me on medication, was astonished at such a dramatic turnaround. Doctors routinely recommend a healthy diet to patients with high blood glucose, but it usually only makes a marginal difference. If others with high blood glucose experience something similar, then intermittent fasting could have a game-changing effect on the nation's health. Fasting and cancer. My father was a lovely man, but not a particularly healthy one. Overweight for much of his life, by the time he reached his 60s, he had developed not only diabetes, but also prostate cancer. He had an operation to remove the cancer that left him with embarrassing urinary problems. Understandably, I am not at all keen to go down that road. My 4-day fast under Professor Longo's supervision had shown me it was possible to dramatically cut my IGF-1 levels and by doing so, hopefully, my prostate cancer risk. I later discovered that intermittent fasting has a similar effect on my IGF-1 levels. The link between growth, fasting and cancer is worth unpacking. The cells in our bodies are constantly multiplying, replacing dead, worn-out or damaged tissue. This is fine as long as cellular growth is under control. But sometimes a cell mutates, grows uncontrollably, and turns into a cancer. Very high levels in the blood of a cellular stimulant like IGF-1 are likely to increase the chance of this happening. When a cancer goes rogue, the normal options are surgery, chemotherapy, or radiotherapy. Surgery is used to try to remove the tumor. Chemotherapy and radiotherapy are there to try and poison it. The major problem with chemotherapy and radiotherapy is they are not selective. As well as killing tumor cells, they will kill or damage surrounding healthy cells. They are particularly likely to damage rapidly dividing cells, such as hair roots, which is why hair commonly falls out following therapy. As I mentioned before, Voltolongo has shown that when we are deprived of food for even quite short periods of time, our body responds by slowing things down, going into repair and survival mode until food is once more abundant. That is true of normal cells, but cancer cells follow their own rules. They are, almost by definition, not under control, and will go on selfishly growing, whatever the circumstances. This selfishness creates an opportunity. If you fast just before chemotherapy, at least in theory, you create a situation where your normal cells are hibernating, while the cancer cells are running amok, and therefore are more vulnerable. In a paper published in 2008, Volter and his colleagues showed that fasting protects normal but not cancer cells against high-dose chemotherapy. They followed this with another paper in which they showed that fasting increased the effectiveness of chemotherapy drugs against a variety of cancers. Again, as is so often the case, this was a study done with mice. But the implications of Volter's work were not missed by an eagle-eyed judge called Nora Quinn, who saw a short article about it in the LA Times. Nora's story. I met Nora in Los Angeles. She is a feisty woman with a terrific dry sense of humor. Nora first noticed she had a problem when one morning she put her hand on her breast and felt a lump the size of a walnut under her skin. After indulging, as she put it, in the fantasy that it was a cyst, it was removed and sent to a pathologist. The reality of your life always comes out in pathology, she told me. When the pathology report came back, it said she had invasive breast cancer. She had a course of radiotherapy and was about to start chemotherapy when she read about Professor Longo's work with mice. She tried to speak to him, but he wouldn't advise her because none of the trials he had run up to that point had been done with humans. He didn't know if it was safe for someone about to undergo chemotherapy to fast, and he certainly wasn't going to encourage people like Nora to give it a go. Undeterred, Nora did her own research and decided to try a 7.5-day water-only fast. It would cover before, during, and after chemotherapy. Having discovered just how tough it can be to do even a 4-day fast while fully healthy, I'm surprised she was able to go through with it. Although Nora found the fasting was not too hard, the results were mixed. After the first chemo, she said, I didn't get that sick, but my hair fell out. So next time, she didn't fast, and she was only medium sick. I thought it wasn't working, she said. I thought 7.5 days of fasting to avoid being medium sick. This is a really bad deal. I am so not doing that again. When it was time for her third course of chemo, she didn't fast. That, she now feels, was a mistake. I got sick. I don't have words for how sick I was. I was weak, felt poisoned. I couldn't get up. I felt like I was moving through jello. It was absolutely horrible. The cells that line the gut, like hair root cells, grow rapidly because they need to be constantly replaced. That's one reason why chemotherapy can make people feel really ill. By the time Nora had to undergo her fourth course of chemo, she had decided once again to try fasting. This time things went much better, and she made a good recovery. She is currently cancer-free. Nora is convinced she benefited from fasting, but it's hard to be sure, because she wasn't part of a proper medical trial. Volta and colleagues at the University of Southern California did, however, study what happened to her and 10 other patients with cancers, who had also decided to put themselves on a fast. All of them reported fewer and less severe symptoms after chemotherapy, and most of them, including Nora, saw improvements in their blood results. The white cells of the immune system and platelets, for example, recovered more rapidly when they had chemo in a fasted state than when they did not. But why did Nora go rogue? Why didn't she fast under proper supervision? "I decided to fast based on years of information from animal testing," she said. "I do agree that if you are going to do crazy things like I do, you should do them under medical supervision. But how? None of my doctors would listen to me." Nora's self-experiment could have gone wrong, which is just one reason why such maverick behaviour is not recommended. Her experience, however, and that of the other 9 cancer patients, helped inspire further studies. For example, Professor Volta Longo and his colleagues have recently completed phase 1 of a clinical trial to see if fasting around the time of chemotherapy is safe, which it seems to be. The next thing is to assess whether it makes any measurable difference. At least 10 other hospitals around the world are either doing or have agreed to do clinical trials. Go to our website, thefastdiet.co.uk. That's thefastdiet.co.uk for the latest updates. Intermittent fasting, my personal journey. I started out by trying the 4-day fast under Professor Volta Longo's supervision. But despite the improvements in my blood biochemistry and his obvious enthusiasm, I could not imagine doing lengthy fasts on a regular basis for the rest of my life. So what next? Well, having met Dr. Krista Varady and learnt all about ADF, alternate day fasting, I decided to give that a go. After a short while, however, I realised it was just too tough physically, socially and psychologically. I need some pattern in my life, and not being able to tell without a calendar and calculations whether I could meet friends for dinner on a particular night was irksome. I also found fasting every other day a little too challenging. I realised that many of Krista's volunteers do manage to stick to it, and it is undoubtedly an effective way to lose weight rapidly and to get powerful changes to your biochemistry. But it was not for me. So I decided to try eating 600 calories for 2 days a week. It seemed a reasonable compromise, and more importantly, doable. I tried eating all my food in one meal, as Krista does in her studies, but discovered that if I skipped breakfast, I started to feel hungry well before lunch. So I split my food in two. A moderate breakfast, missed lunch, a light supper. And I did it twice a week. This I found extremely manageable. After experimenting with different versions of fasting, I found the 5-2 approach is the most effective and workable for me to get the benefits of fasting and still retain a long-term commitment to a dietary plan. Before embarking on the diet, I decided to get myself properly tested to see what effects it would have on my body. The following are the tests I did. Most are straightforward. The blood tests are, with one exception, tests your doctor should be happy to do for you. Get on the scales. The first and most obvious thing you will want to do is weigh yourself before embarking on this adventure. Initially, it is best to do this at the same time every day. First thing in the morning is, as I'm sure you know, when you will be at your lightest. Body fat. Ideally, you should get a weighing machine that measures body fat percentage as well as weight, since what you really want to see is body fat levels fall. The cheaper machines are not fantastically reliable. They tend to underestimate the true figure, giving you a false sense of security. What they are quite good at doing, however, is measuring change. In other words, they might tell you when you start that you are 30% body fat, when the true figure is closer to 33%. But they should be able to tell you when that number begins to fall. Body fat is measured as a percentage of total weight. The machines you can buy do this using a system called impedance. There's a small electric current that runs through your body. The machine measures the resistance. It does its estimation based on the fact that muscle and other tissues are better conductors of electricity than fat. Women tend to have more body fat than men. A man with a body fat percentage of more than 25% would be considered overweight. For a woman, it would be 30%. The only way to get a truly accurate reading is with a machine called a DXA scanner. It is expensive and, for most people, unnecessary. Calculate your BMI. Your body mass index, your BMI, will tell you if you are overweight. To calculate your body mass index, go to a website. There are a lot of BMI calculators on the web. One criticism of BMI is that someone who has a lot of muscle could get a high BMI score. This is not an issue for most of us, sadly. Measure your stomach. BMI is useful, but it may not be the best predictor of future health. In a study of more than 45,000 women who were followed for 16 years, the waist-to-height ratio was a superior predictor of who would develop heart disease. The reason the waist matters so much is because the worst sort of fat is visceral fat, which collects inside the abdomen. This is the worst sort of distribution because it causes inflammation and puts you at higher risk of diabetes. You don't need fancy equipment to tell you if you have internal fat. All you need is a tape measure. Male or female, your waist should be less than half your height. If you're 6 feet high, your waist should be less than 36 inches. If you're 5 feet 4, then it's 32 inches. Most people underestimate their waist size by about 2 inches because they rely on trouser size. Instead, measure your waist by putting the tape measure around your belly button. Be honest. A definition of optimism is someone who steps on the scale while holding their breath. You are fooling no one. Blood tests. You should be able to get standard tests during a routine visit to your doctor. I chose to measure my fasting glucose because it is a really important measure of fitness, even if you are not at risk of diabetes. It is also a powerful predictor of future health. Studies show that even moderately elevated levels of blood glucose are associated with increased risk of heart disease, stroke, and long-term cognitive problems. Ideally, I would also have had my insulin sensitivity measured, but that test is complex and expensive. Cholesterol. Doctors routinely measure two types of cholesterol: LDL, low-density lipoprotein, and HDL, high-density lipoprotein. Broadly speaking, LDL carries cholesterol into the walls of your arteries, while HDL carries it away. It is good to have a lowish LDL and a highish HDL. Triglycerides. These are a type of fat that is found in blood. They are one of the ways that the body stores calories. High levels are associated with increased risk of heart disease. IGF-1. This is an expensive test and is not available from every doctor. It is a measure of cell turnover and therefore of cancer risk. It may also be a marker for biological aging. I wanted to find out the effects of intermittent fasting on my IGF-1 levels. I had discovered that IGF-1 levels dropped dramatically in response to a 4-day fast. But disappointingly, after a month of normal eating, they bounced right back to where they had been before. My data. Before I started, I was 187 pounds and my body fat was 28%. I knew that much of this fat was collected internally, wrapping itself in thick layers around my liver and kidneys. Now, clearly the fat wasn't all just inside my abdomen. Quite a bit had collected around my neck. I was snoring loudly. Neck size is actually a powerful predictor of whether you will snore or not. A neck size above 16.5 inches for men or 16 inches for women means you are in the danger zone. As I've said before, my fasting glucose was worryingly high. the level of a diabetic. My cholesterol and my IGF-1 levels were also far too high. After 3 months on the fast diet, there were some remarkable changes. I'd lost 19 pounds, almost all of it fat. My body fat had gone down from 28% to 21%. I had to go out and buy smaller belts and tighter trousers. I could fit into a dinner jacket I hadn't worn for 10 years. I'd also stopped snoring, which delighted my wife. Even better, my blood indicators had improved in a spectacular fashion. My fasting glucose, cholesterol, and IGF-1 levels, which had all been way too high, were now in the normal range. If you want details, you can find them in the PDF. My wife, Claire, who is a doctor, was astonished. She regularly sees overweight patients with blood chemistry like mine, and she said that none of the advice she gives them had anything like the same effect. Claire, however, felt I was losing weight a little too fast, and I should consolidate for a while, which is why I decided to go on a maintenance dose of fasting just one day a week. My weight has stayed steady at 168 pounds, and my blood markers remain in good shape. So, what is the best way to go about intermittent fasting? Let's recap what we've learned. The reason for intermittent fasting, that is, briefly but severely restricting the amount of calories you consume, is that by doing so you are hoping to fool your body into thinking it is in a potential famine situation and that it needs to switch from go-go mode to maintenance mode. The reason our bodies respond to fasting in this way is that we evolved at a time when feast or famine was the norm. Our bodies are designed to respond to stresses and shocks. It makes them healthier, tougher. The scientific term is hormesis. What does not kill you makes you stronger. The benefits of fasting include weight loss, a reduction of IGF-1, which means you are reducing your risk of a number of age-related diseases, such as cancer, the switching on of repair genes in response to this stressor, giving your pancreas a rest, which will boost the effectiveness of the insulin it produces in response to elevated blood glucose. Increased insulin sensitivity should reduce your risk of obesity, diabetes, heart disease, and cognitive decline. An overall enhancement in your mood and sense of well-being. This may be a consequence of your brain producing increased levels of neurotrophic factor, which will hopefully make you more cheerful and in turn should make fasting more doable. So much for the science. In the next chapter, we discuss what to eat and how to go about starting life as an intermittent faster. How do you put the theory into practice?
The fast diet in practice. So there are, as we've seen, good clinical reasons to start intermittent fasting. Some, such as its positive effect on blood markers, should be immediately apparent. Others will be manifest over time: a cognitive boost, a self-repairing physiology, a greater chance of a longer life. But perhaps the most compelling argument for many is the promise of swift and sustained weight loss, while still eating the foods you enjoy most of the time. You may view this as incidental to the plan's other marked health benefits, or it may be your primary objective. The fact is, you will gain both, weight loss and better health, two sides of the same page. Michael's experience, as described in the previous chapter, will have given you an idea of what to expect. In this chapter, I will reveal more detail, explaining how to start, how it will feel, how to keep going, and how the central tenets of the fast diet can slip easily into the rhythm of your everyday life. Now, it's over to you. What do 500 to 600 calories look like? Cutting calories to a quarter of your usual daily intake is a significant commitment, so don't be surprised if your first fast day feels like a tough gig. As you progress, the fasts will become second nature, and the initial sense of deprivation will diminish, particularly if you remain aware that tomorrow is another day, in fact, when you can eat as you please. Still, however you cut it, 500 or 600 calories is no picnic. It's not even half a picnic. A large cafe latte can clock in at over 300 calories, more if you insist on cream, while your usual lunchtime sandwich might easily consume your entire allowance in one huge bite. So be smart. Spend your calories wisely. The menu plans described later and in the PDF will be useful, but it's also worth having a clear idea of your favourite fast day foods that work for you. Remember to embrace variety, differing textures, punchy flavours, colour and crunch. Together, these things will keep your mouth entertained and stop it frowning at the hardship of it all. When to fast? Animal studies, human studies, research, experiment. As Michael has just described, evidence for the value of fasting is unequivocal. But what happens when you step out of the laboratory and into real life? When and what you eat during your fast is critical to the diet's success. So what's the optimal pattern? Michael tried several different fasting regimes. The one he settled on as the most realistic and sustainable is a fast on 2 non-consecutive days each week, allowing 600 calories a day, split between breakfast and dinner. This pattern has been called, for obvious reasons, a 5-2 diet. 5 days off, 2 days on, which means that the majority of your time is spent gloriously free from calorie counting. On a fast day, Michael will normally have breakfast with the family at 7:30 a.m. and then aim to have dinner with them at 7:30 p.m. with nothing eaten in between. That way he gets 2 12-hour fasts in a day and a happy family at the end of it. The menu suggestions are based on this pattern, as it is, in his experience, the most straightforward and convincing intermittent fasting method. As will become clear later, I found a slightly different pattern works for me. Sticking to the fast diet's central tenet, I eat 500 calories, but as 2 meals with a few snacks, an apple, some carrot sticks, in between, simply because the vast plain between breakfast and supper feels too great, too empty for comfort. There is evidence from trials conducted by Dr. Michelle Harvey and others that this approach will help you lose weight, reduce your risk of breast cancer, and increase insulin sensitivity. Which approach is better? At this point, given the science of intermittent fasting is still in its infancy, we don't know. On purely theoretical grounds, a longer period without food, Michael's pattern, might be expected to produce better results than one where you eat smaller amounts more frequently. But as far as we're aware, there have as yet been no studies which attempt to compare the health benefits to people on a fasting day of either eating their calories in one go, split up, or spread throughout the day. When we know more, we will update you. Professor Mark Mattson at the National Institute on Aging says that by eating your calories as a single meal, you might get a modestly greater ketogenic or fat-burning effect compared to 3 very small meals spread through the day. But he also thinks that we shouldn't get too hung up about it. He says, regardless of whether the 600 calories is consumed as 1 meal or 2 or 3 smaller meals, you will get major health benefits. We await more trials, but it's already clear from the hundreds who've tried it that as long as you stick to the fast diet, you will enjoy that crucial combination of weight loss, health benefit, and cheerful compliance. Some people who don't feel hungry at breakfast would rather eat later in the day. That's fine. One of the key researchers in this field often starts her day with a late breakfast at around 11 o'clock and finishes with supper at 7. That way she's fasting for 16 hours a day, twice a week. Based on the mouse study cited earlier, it may even be a better approach. It is, however, only better if you actually do it. And a delayed breakfast may not suit some lifestyles, timetables, or bodies. So go with a timetable that suits you. Some fasters will appreciate the convenience and simplicity of a single 500 or 600 calorie meal, allowing them to ignore food entirely for most of the day. Whatever you choose, it must be your plan, your life. Do it with gusto, but be prepared to experiment within the limits set out by the plan. What to eat? It may seem curious to talk about what to eat when you're fasting. But the fast diet is a modified program, allowing 500 calories for a woman and 600 for a man on any given fast day, making the regime relatively comfortable and, above all, sustainable over the long term. So yes, you do get to eat on a fast day, but it matters what you choose. There are two general principles that should govern what you eat and what you avoid on a fast day. Your aim is to have food that makes you feel satisfied, but stays firmly within the 500 to 600 calorie allowance. And the best options to achieve this are foods that are high in protein and foods with a low glycemic index, or GI. There have been a number of studies demonstrating that individuals who eat a diet higher in protein feel fuller longer. Indeed, the main reason why people lose weight on diets like Atkins is because they eat less. The trouble with really high protein diets, however, is that people tend to get bored of the food restrictions and give up. There's also evidence that high protein diets are associated with higher levels of chronic inflammation and IGF-1, which in turn are associated with increased risk of heart disease and cancer. So the fast diet doesn't recommend boycotting carbs entirely or living permanently on a high protein diet. However, on a fast day, the combination of proteins and foods with a low GI will be helpful weapons in keeping hunger at bay. Understanding the glycemic index. Earlier, we discovered the importance of blood sugar and insulin. High levels of insulin, brought about by high levels of blood sugar, will encourage your body to store fat and increase your cancer risk. Another reason not to eat foods that make your blood sugar levels surge, particularly on your fast days, is that when your blood sugar crashes, as it inevitably will, you will start feeling very hungry indeed. Carbohydrates have the biggest impact on blood sugars, but not all carbs are equal. As habitual dieters will know, one way to discover which carbs cause a big spike and which don't is to look at their GI. Each food gets a score out of 100, with a low score meaning that the particular food does not tend to cause a rapid rise in blood glucose. These are the ones you want. The size of the sugar spike depends both on the food itself and on how much of it you eat. For example, we tend to eat a lot more potatoes in one sitting than kiwi fruit. So there's also a measure called GL, the glycemic load. This is the GI score times grams of carbohydrate divided by 100. Now, this makes some pretty heroic assumptions about the amount of a particular food you're likely to eat as a portion, but at least it's a guide. The reason GI and GL are interesting is not just because they are strongly predictive of future health. People on a low GL diet have less risk of diabetes, heart disease, and various cancers, but also because there are so many surprises. Who would have imagined that eating a baked potato would have as big an impact on your blood glucose as eating a tablespoon of sugar? Broadly speaking, a GI over 50 or a GL over 20 is not good, and the lower both figures are, the better. It is worth restating that GI and GL are measures that relate to carbohydrates. GI is not relevant to protein and fats, which is why none of the food mentioned have a significant protein or fat content. As an example, let's take a quick look at breakfast. Porridge has a GI of 50 and a GL quite low at 10, so does muesli. A baguette, however, has double the GI, almost, at 95, but comes in with a GL of 15. A croissant is 67 on GI, 17 on GL. But let's look at cornflakes, which have a GI of 80. Cornflakes have a GL of 20, double that of porridge or muesli. You'll find this table in the PDF. So you can see why, if you're having a carb breakfast, porridge and muesli are better options than cornflakes or a croissant. And what are you going to put on your muesli? Well, the relatively high GI and GL of soy milk is just one reason to stick with dairy. If you have milk, the GI is 27 and the GL is 3. If you choose soy milk, the GI is 44, but the GL is more than double at 8. The relatively high GI and GL of soy milk is just one reason to stick with dairy. And since we're handing out surprises, here's another one. Ice cream? GI of 37, but a very small GL of 4. You might bet your house on ice cream being high GI and GL, but not so. If you factor it into your calorie count, low-calorie ice cream with strawberries is a treat to round off a meal. For more on GI and GL of various foods and how best to plan your fast day foods, see the PDF. What about protein? We certainly don't recommend eating protein to the exclusion of all else on a fast day, but you do require an adequate quantity for muscle health, cell maintenance, endocrine regulation, immunity, and energy. Protein is satiating too, so it's well worth including it in your calorie quota. While Valter Longo recommends 0.8 of a gram of protein per kilogram of body weight per day, which would give a 12-stone man around 60 grams and a 9-stone woman around 45 grams, perhaps the simplest method is to stick to recommended governmental guidelines, which allow for a quite generous 50 grams per day. Go for good protein. Steamed white fish, for example, is low in saturated fats and rich in minerals. Choose skinless chicken over red meat. Try low-fat dairy products over endless lattes. Include prawns, tuna, tofu and other plant proteins. Nuts, seeds, pulses and legumes are full of fibre and act as bulking agents on a hungry day. Nuts, though high in calories, depending of course on how many you eat, are generally low GI and brilliantly satiating. They are fatty too, so you might imagine that they are bad for you. Yet the evidence is that nut consumers have lower rates of heart disease and diabetes than nut abstainers. Eggs, meanwhile, are low in saturated fat and full of nutritional value. They won't adversely affect your cholesterol levels, and they score a mere 85 calories each, so an egg-based breakfast on a fast day makes perfect sense. 2 eggs plus a 50-gram serving of smoked salmon, for example, clocks in at a sensible 250 calories. Research recently found that individuals who consume egg protein for breakfast are more likely to feel full during the day than those whose breakfasts contain wheat protein. Poaching or boiling an egg avoids the addition of careless calories. Stand down the toast soldiers and replace with steamed asparagus spears. For more suggestions about food to keep you full and fit on a fast day, and the benefits certain choices will bring, turn to the PDF. How to fit fasting into your life. When to start. If you do not have an underlying medical condition, and if you're not an individual for whom fasting is inadvisable, which we'll come to later, then there is really no time like the present to start fasting. Ask yourself, if not now, when?